Okay, this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to talk to you about the Moon Day that's coming up in Dallas here in July. And we have with us Ken Murphy, who's going to talk to us and who's the organizer of that activity, but has a lot more to talk to us about. And Judge John Marshall, who's one of the pioneers of the Apollo program, but also a sitting judge and an expert on cyber ethics. So Ken, walk us into Moon Day and what are we celebrating?
Well, Moon Day is an event that we created here in Dallas back in 2009 to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. But rather than just being exclusively a celebration of Apollo, we decided to structure it so that it really is about the future of space exploration and where we're going to be going, you know, tomorrow versus where we were yesterday. And as a result of that, we've structured it so that we have lots of exhibitors, we have lots of classes and lectures, we distribute a ton of information to the visitors, and we really try to make it a very spacey experience.
Very good. So one of your contributions to thinking about the future of space is this rather technical term of cislunar iconosphere. What is that, and how is that going to help us?
Yes, I often get the question, WTF is cislunar? And it's a simple word. It's from the Latin prefix CIS or cis, which means bounded by or on the near side of. It can be thought of as fenced in by. And then, of course, lunar refers to our moon. So when I talk about cislunar space, I'm talking about the area of space that's encompassed by the moon's orbit, which actually covers most of our activities in space, from the Hubble telescope to the Dish TV, DirecTV, Sirius, all of those activities, and eventually our activities on the moon.
And one of the analogies or metaphors we talked about is that indeed the Earth is sitting deep in this gravitational well, and it takes a lot of energy to get out of that hole. And so the sensible place to develop space economy and so on is indeed in the cislunar environment, where once you're there, it's really easy to get around. And the analogy we made was that human beings don't build towns on mountaintops because it takes a lot of work to get up there and down again. And so you tend to build the mountains and the valleys and so on. So what are we going to do in cislunar space?
Well, like I said, there's a lot of assets that are out there. For example, geosynchronous satellites. There are many, many dead, inoperable geosynchronous satellites that really we need to be cleaning up and getting out of there so that we can put more working infrastructure in place. But geosynchronous is very tough to get to. And so we don't do anything there and we let these what are called zombie sats just keep wandering around out there. So once we're out into cislunar space and doing operations on the moon, we can also operate in geosynchronous orbit. And for example, from the Earth-Moon Lagrange 1 point, it's easier to get to geosynchronous orbit and back than it is to get from low Earth orbit out to geosynchronous.
So some of the activities would not only be maintaining our space infrastructure, as you said, we now are heavily dependent on geosynchronous orbit, where all the telecom satellites and the GPS satellites are located. And so over the next centuries, we're going to have to keep repairing them and replacing them and upgrading them.
And upgrading them. If you've ever had your Dish or DirecTV go out in the rain,
yeah,
it's because the solar panels don't provide enough power to punch through that rain.
And launching a rocket.
If we can get there, we can put bigger solar panels on.
Well, and launching a rocket from the surface of the Earth is a pretty stupid way of doing that. Once you're up there in cislunar space, you can just go in, take out the dead satellite, bring a new one in.
Exactly.
And have the maintenance station in orbit.
Mm-hmm. And even beyond that, yeah, instead of taking out the whole satellite, maybe you take off an instrument and just replace it with a new instrument, which would be a lot cheaper to ship up from Earth.
That's right. What other kind of industries can you imagine happening in the cislunar iconosphere?
Well, one of the most popular ones that people like to talk about is solar power satellites, where we have large solar arrays in geosynchronous orbit that can provide 24/7, 365 electricity in the form of microwaves being beamed down to the surface of the Earth. And not microwave oven microwaves, it's a different frequency, so there's not the issues there. But the sun will not burn out for over 4 billion years. And so it's a good long-term energy source.
Okay.
There's also many, many resources that are available on the moon that we could put to work.
Okay, Judge Marshall is chuckling there. I'd like to get you into the discussion. So you were very involved in the early days of the Apollo program. Tell us a little bit about that and how you think about the cislunar iconosphere.
Well, I was privileged to be an historian in the Apollo program and to write the history of the launch operations of the Apollo Saturn V at the Kennedy Space Center. And needless to say, it, for someone who as a child enjoyed fireworks, I was playing with really big rockets at that time, and that was a great thrill. But the thing that comes to mind about that is that space exploration is something that we as a species have undertaken really for a wide range of reasons, and Ken has talked about some of them, and I think in the cislunar environment, you have tremendous opportunities, because if you want to go all the way to the moon and do some mining there or something of that sort, bringing them back to the Lagrangian point and then transporting them to the Earth would be, in some respects, for some of these items, probably much cheaper than mining them on Earth. And you know, there's no telling what we would be able to find in that respect.
Plus, we would be moving the pollution off the Earth into virgin space. That's a discussion.
That's right.
One of the things that you've mentioned to us is that as you were doing the history of the early Apollo program, you became aware that there was a film that many of these engineers had seen as kids. What was that film? And some of their design choices were actually influenced by that film.
The movie was called Die Frau im Mond, the Girl in the Moon, and it was produced in 1929 by the German film director Fritz Lang. And we know that Wernher von Braun, who is sometimes billed as the father of the American space program, saw that film, and he and Willy Ley, who were earlier pioneers in rocketry and rocket science in Germany, were profoundly influenced by that. In particular, how to build a spacecraft and vehicle to get off the Earth and go in sequences, in stages, if you will, to ultimately land on the moon. And the engineering and the portrayal of this in the movie was translated by von Braun during his life as an engineer into what became the Kennedy Space Center, and how we assembled the Apollo Saturn V vehicles and vertically, and then transported them out to the launch pad, and all of this sort of thing. You see it all in the film.
Very good, Ken. So how do you see this link between films, science fiction, and the future of space?
Well, a lot of people think of it as space activities as a scientific endeavor or an engineering endeavor or that sort of thing. And some of us regard it as a human cultural endeavor. And by being a human cultural endeavor, it incorporates a lot of the different aspects of our society and our culture that go beyond engineering and science. We were talking earlier about some of the visual representations of these activities and how art helps us to envision how these things might turn out in the future and what we might be capable of going forward. So art definitely has a very strong role to play.
Okay, let's take this in a different direction, just hearing you talk again. So one of the things that you explained to us is how you got into the space business in the first place, and you come out of the financial industry. So what are you doing in the space business?
It's something I often ask myself. but my perspective as someone who comes from a business background is that I want to see prosperity for our future, what I call prosperity for our posterity. I want growing economies. I want growing wealth and access to that wealth for the people of planet Earth. And so by tapping the resources and the energy that are available all around us in space, huge quantities of it in space are available to us if we reach out and touch it. And so what I've been trying to do is, you know, explain to people and show people why this is such an important activity and why it's something that we need to be doing, not just as a culture, but as a species.
What a different story you just told than what John told about the birth of the Apollo program. So what, you know, tell us about the birth of the Apollo program and its context. You also told this wonderful story about the cost.
Well, in May of 1961, President Kennedy gave a speech which was frankly a product of the Cold War, and it was a challenge to the Soviet Union at the time, which had already sent men into space and all of this sort of thing. And he announced that the objective of the United States was to land a man on the moon by the end of the decade. Well, this speech was not vetted by anybody in NASA, and so it came as quite a surprise to all of the NASA engineers that this was now going to be their task. And so the next day, the NASA administrator at the time, James Webb, was confronted with a big press conference, and they said, well, Mr. Webb, tell us, how much is this going to cost the American taxpayer? Well, Webb, of course, there was no planning of any type to give a clue as to what this was going to cost. So he simply pulled a number out of the air, and he said, oh, well, he said, I believe that we can do this for $22 billion.
Not 20, 22.
22, very precise number. And so they said, okay, $22 billion. And that became the benchmark for the Apollo program. Well, in the end, when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon in constant dollars over the eight-year period, sure enough, the Apollo program had cost the American taxpayers $22.5 billion in actual expenditures. But what's really interesting is all of the fringe benefits from the research and development that was required to get us to the moon that has come into everyday use, particularly such things as medical appliances like the pacemakers and so forth, that are a clear product of that time period.
Okay, well, we've got a few minutes to wrap this up. So, Ken, I'm going to throw the ball to you on return on investment. So indeed, when Kennedy committed $22 billion, nobody did the return on investment calculation. So tell us the return on investment on the cislunar econosphere.
Oh, boy, is that a question out of left field.
Because we're in a different time,
right? Has been looked at. Back in the 1970s, I believe it was, Citigroup actually sat down and tried to figure out the value of the readily identifiable, what are called spin-offs, spin-off technologies from the space program, and how they had benefited the U.S. economy. And they guesstimated, if I remember correctly, it was like a six-fold return on the investment as far as what benefits we derived from.
But that was post hoc, right? They didn't use that reasoning before the money was spent.
Propter hoc, no, exactly right. They were looking at efforts.
So now
they needed that perspective of time to be able to see what had been happening with those spin-offs.
But you can't predict what spin-offs will come off from the econosphere.
Absolutely not, because of a lot of engineering limitations. We talk about things like helium-3 fusion, which is only 10 years away, which is where it's been for the last six decades. So, you know. But then you look at things like fly-by-wire, which is the Apollo capsule was a fly-by-wire capsule, and then that technology evolved into aviation, and now all the planes use it. So, I mean, how do you measure the value of that?
Okay, so we're going to wrap this up in 2 minutes. So you tried to convince me a few minutes ago that it would be economically sensible to import moon dust to
in bulk
help Earth agriculture. So let me tell you, I was pretty skeptical then, and I'm pretty skeptical now. So try again.
Okay. Well, the basic idea here is that it's based on results that were seen back in the 1970s when they did plant growth experiments in real regolith. Everything since then, including recent research people may have seen online, has been done in regolith simulant, which is a mechanical...
Regolith is moon dust.
Moon dust, yeah. Although the term is also used here on Earth in some cases. But that is an engineering and mechanical substitute for moon dust. It doesn't represent the fine chemical composition of the moon dust. And it's thought that moon dust contains the trace elements from eons of bombardment by meteorites and asteroids and that sort of thing, smacking into the moon and distributing their contents into and throughout the soil. Here on Earth, we've been industrially farming for thousands of years. As a result, we've industrially farmed out a lot of those trace elements from our agricultural areas, and that's why we have to do things like add fertilizer to the soil to make the plants keep growing. Yeah. So it's entirely possible. I'm not saying it's a sure thing, but if we can bring back this dirt that is rich in trace elements, mix that in with our soil, we may get a good response as a consequence.
Okay, so John, we're going to have the last word on this. So it was Fritz Lang who made the movie, is that right?
That's correct.
What was the name of the movie? What were they trying to get from the moon?
the girl on the moon. They were trying to get gold. What else?
So, creative disturbance, we're going to go get dirt from the moon. Thank you, John. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.